current numbers as we look at them. The wind is calm, the humidity 93%, 73 degrees as our clock comes up on 8:11. The Morning Show with Greg Berg up next. WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Frank Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and a Morning Show co-host.
Where does it begin when we are talking about talented and skilled authors and illustrators who are so good at what they did? What about when they were children and just getting the notion of maybe writing their own stories or creating their own illustrations? There is a wonderful book that has just been published called Our Story Begins. Your favorite authors and illustrators share fun, inspiring, and occasionally ridiculous things they wrote and drew as kids. And in this wonderful little book, you get to see with your own eyes examples from the childhoods of an array of well-known authors and writers and illustrators. And it is so fascinating to see in most cases the initial spark of very impressive talent, which of course has come to wonderful fruition years later. And my guest is the editor of this book, Alyssa Brent Weissman, and she happens to be one of the talented people whose early work is represented in this book. She is the award-winning author of five different novels intended for young readers, including The Short Seller, Nerd Camp, and Nerd Camp 2.0. And she is the editor of this book, which is published by Athenium Books for Young Readers. Again, it's called Our Story Begins. Your favorite authors and illustrators share fun, inspiring, and occasionally ridiculous things they wrote and drew as kids. And Alyssa Brent Weissman, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed this book, and it's just an absolutely fantastic idea. I assume that it was your idea, or was it someone else's?
No, it was my idea, although when I thought of it, I couldn't believe that it hadn't already been someone else's idea. I thought for sure when I had the idea for a collection of stories and drawings that authors, especially children's authors and illustrators, created when they were their reader's age, I thought for sure that somebody else had already done it. And I went online and looked and looked, and I couldn't find anything like it, and decided that then I would be the one to put it together.
I want you to share with our listeners essentially what you talk about in the preface of the book, and it starts with this sentence: our story begins with a box and a basement.
That's right.
A box in a basement. And
right.
And tell us what was in that box and how it
sure.
was marked.
Well, I'll start with the basement, which was in the house where I grew up, where my parents still live. And I was home visiting them, and my mom wanted me to go through some of the boxes with my name on them in the basement. And I did so, and I found one box that was just filled completely to the top, and it was a big box with all stories that I wrote as a kid. So there were notebooks of every type, marble notebooks, spiral notebooks. There were handwritten stories on paper. There were some that I'd typed on my dad's old typewriter. And I started going through this box, and it was so much fun. And some of the stories really made me laugh because they were very, very clever for someone young. And some of them made me laugh because they were just so terrible. And I started thinking about how now, as an author, I do a lot of visits to schools, and I talk about the fact that when I was in fifth grade, I wrote a novel and tried unsuccessfully to get it published. And many times after I tell that story, a lot of the kids will ask me if they can read that book or if I'm ever going to do anything with that book. And I started to think that, you know, I couldn't be the only one with a box like this in a basement somewhere. And I wondered what some of my favorite authors wrote when they were kids, or if they wrote at all. And then I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool to see drawings that illustrators created when they were kids? And so as I said, I realized nobody else had done this before. So I started to ask. I talked to some other authors and illustrators that I knew. And I started to hear such wonderful, wonderful stories about themselves as young, you know, just starting to experiment and explore, that I thought, you know, I'd love to put together these stories about these authors and illustrators as kids, along with the actual work that they have saved. And what resulted is this book, Our Story Begins.
So did you end up contacting authors and illustrators that you already knew? I mean, by and large, is that what we're talking about here in terms of the
people?
No,
that's how it began, to make sure that there were people who thought this was a good idea and had something saved. What really got the ball rolling was I was at a Simon & Schuster dinner, and I was sitting next to Candace Fleming, who is a very well-known, successful author for young readers, and she was on one side of me, and Tim Federle, who is another well-known, hilarious author for young readers, on the other side. And I was especially talking to Candace about this, and she told me a great story of how when she was in about fifth grade, she wrote a story, and she thought that it deserved a medal. So she scraped the Newbery sticker off of her class copy of The Witch of Blackbird Pond and stuck it on her handwritten story. And I thought, this is the kind of thing that needs to go in a book like this alongside the actual story that she wrote at that time. And when I decided to put it together, Candace was very interested in being involved, and her partner and illustrator, Eric Roman, who's a Caldecott-winning illustrator, she said he also had stuff saved from when he was little, and they were willing to ask more of their friends, and they knew a lot more people in the community than I did at the time. And so the list, I started to build the list from there. Tim Federle, who was sitting on the other side of me, ends up being in the book as well. And from there, my editor at Simon & Schuster and I tried to think about who we might want to approach to be in the book. And most of the people in the book I have never met personally. Even now, after working with them for a couple years on this, most of the communication has been over email.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
One thing that is I found intriguing was reading about a couple of different reasons why certain people declined to participate, declined to have some of their earlier work included in this collection, and for, you know, a real variation of reasons. I think this is just kind of interesting to think about, and it also, I think, helps us appreciate then the decision by all of the writers and illustrators who are part of this book to, in fact, make this kind of material available to you and to all of us. Talk for a moment about what compelled certain people to not be part of this.
Sure. Well, some people that I contacted just simply didn't have anything for a couple of reasons. Some of them, who are now extremely successful, well-known authors, didn't write at all as kids. I had one person tell me, I went to Catholic school, I didn't write anything creative until I was an adult. I had someone else tell me she did schoolwork, but then otherwise didn't pick up a pen until she was about 40 years old, and so they simply didn't have anything. Other people wrote lots and lots or drew lots and lots, but didn't save anything, or quite frequently they told me my mom didn't save anything. And so for that reason, those people couldn't be in the book either. I had one author who was so disappointed she couldn't participate. She said she wrote for her high school or junior high newspaper. She reported on boys' sports, and she went so far as to call her old school and see if they had any records of it, but they don't, and this was before the time when it would have been online. Some other people did write, and they did save, but what they had they considered too personal to share, which I completely understand. And some other people maybe had something, but they were just too busy with, you know, their careers and their families and everything else that they have going on that they didn't really have time to go looking for it or to participate in something like this. So there were lots of reasons why people didn't want to be involved. But what was really nice was that pretty much everyone I reached out to, I heard back from, and everyone was very warm and excited about the idea and just, you know, happy to talk to me. And so it was a real honor and pleasure for me to be talking to some of these people that I admire so much and get to speak to them a little bit about themselves when they were kids.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Alyssa Brent Weissman about a book that she has helped to create and edit called Our Story Begins. Your favorite authors and illustrators share fun, inspiring, and occasionally ridiculous things they wrote and drew as kids. And that pretty much sums up what this book is all about. And it is endlessly fascinating and inspiring, really, as well. I think a good place for us to go at this point is to Chapter 10, which is your own contribution to this book, I mean, specifically. And we should maybe mention that the format of the book is that we see a photograph of each author or illustrator, I would assume, from roughly the time that the material originates. So in your case, it's a nice, perky school photo, it appears to be, and maybe from about the third grade, or I'm not sure. But anyway, and then the author or illustrator talks a little bit about the example that you are about to see. So tell our listeners about what you ended up submitting for this book.
Sure. So I talk a little bit about how I wanted to be an author, a children's author specifically. From the time I was very little, and I put that desire into words in about the third grade when all of my friends somehow decided they were going to be children's authors, and I said I would be too. And within a couple weeks, they'd moved on to wanting to be other things, and I stuck with wanting to be a children's author, and here I am today. I was always kind of lying across my floor, scribbling in notebooks, writing story after story. And by the time I was in fifth and sixth grade, I decided that it was time to get my career started because I wanted to be like the author Gordon Corman, who actually is in the book as well, who amazingly published his first book when he was in seventh grade, when he was 13 years old. And I knew that as a kid, and he was one of my favorite authors, and that was just so, so cool and endlessly inspiring to me. I got to meet him. I interviewed him for a project, and I took a picture with him that also appears in the book, in this book, Our Story Begins. And so I wrote a novel called The Ryland Revolt about a pair of twins, a boy and a girl, who are playing tricks on their substitute teacher. And I sent it off to try to be published. But unfortunately, despite all of my dreams and plans, nobody wanted to publish the book. And so that kind of luckily didn't stop me from wanting to become an author. I kept working at it and kept trying. But that's what I talk about here. And then the first chapter of that book, The Ryland Revolt, follows here in this book. And it's about 3 pages long, single space. So, and then what I think is really cool is that right, I think it's before my chapter, is Gordon Corman's chapter himself. So it's kind of, I think I say in this book, in my introduction, how, you know, 10-year-old Alyssa would really be pinching herself to be in a book right next to Gordon Corman. And even as an adult, here I am kind of pinching myself.
Right. one of the things that jumped out at me about his chapter, that is Gordon Corman, is the picture of him accompanying his chapter is a picture of him, a photo of him, looking like a rugged young hockey player.
Right.
And we don't, I mean, it's kind of fun to have our stereotype sort of blown out of the water that all youngsters who love to write and aspire to be authors are kind of bookworm type,
right,
shy with glasses and so on. And this guy does not look like he was that kind of boy at all, but he must have had a real exceptional talent.
I think so. I mean, and you can see that in the piece that he has in here, which is a speech that he gave in a fifth grade public speaking unit that I think called How to Handle Your Parents, which is just absolutely hysterical. I think when he chose that hockey picture for this book, he also wanted to call attention to his Canadian upbringing.
Ah.
So he wanted to make sure that that came through in the picture, too, that he grew up in Canada.
Hmm. Let's turn back to your own very early writing, and then we'll talk about some of the other examples that are in this book. What was the experience like for you to go through this book, filled right up to the brim with examples from your early childhood? You've already kind of talked about how most of it made you laugh for various reasons. Some of it was pretty good. Some of it was pretty awful as you assess it now. But on kind of an emotional level, what was this like for you to read your own work from so many years before, work which I assume you hadn't seen in decades?
Right. I hadn't. It's a strange kind of surreal experience, as I think anybody can associate with if you've ever looked through belongings or anything from when you were younger, because I had a vague memory, or I had a clear memory of writing some of these things, and then other things I'd completely forgotten about, and some I see them, and then the memories kind of come flooding back. But I think what mostly came through going through the box is I think I say in the introduction to this book, is it any wonder I became a writer? And I think that was the main feeling that came through to me. I mean, just the sheer quantity of things in this box. And then again, some people who are writers now didn't write at all as a kid, but I must have been spending so much time writing. And these stories, and I wrote mysteries that mostly remained unsolved because they were too mysterious and I couldn't figure out a solution. I had stories from, kindergarten or first grade, and they were kind of well-formed stories with characters and a conflict, which I think is incredibly impressive, especially now that I have children of my own, and I look at the things that they're doing, and not to say that their work isn't impressive because it is, but just the way that all of us kind of find something that we're interested in, and maybe from a very early age, we're passionate about it. And I think what's really cool about was going through that box and then also seeing in all of the other work that I collected for this book is just that kind of uninhibited, raw passion for something. I mean, I'm a better writer now. I'm certainly, my craft is much better. I've honed it. But I'm not that kid anymore who just, the work is so silly and so exuberant, and I didn't care at all. I didn't think at all, really, about who was going to be reading it and what they might say about it. I was just putting it all out there on the page, which I think, it just shows all of this personality, and I kind of wish I could almost get back to that place a little bit now.
You know, it's interesting to hear of your sort of insatiable hunger to write. And I wonder, you give no indication of how this, in a sense, was off-putting to any of your peers. Is this something you freely shared? I mean, for instance, with your friends? I mean, were you viewed to any extent as someone kind of strange because you had this ferocious appetite to write and also these aspirations? I mean, you were bound and determined to be a published writer before you turned 13.
Right.
I mean, so that I should think, at least to some extent, puts you a bit out of step with some of your peers.
Well, I will say that now I write books called Nerd Camp, so I can certainly I'd say I'm a proud nerd. But I don't think, even though I was doing this in my free time, I really was, even like my characters in Nerd Camp, I wasn't really, as far as I know, socially awkward. I had lots of friends. I did lots of other things. I did a lot of theater growing up, which I think is kind of another form of storytelling too, and kind of inhabiting other characters and telling stories in that way. And I played tennis and I did other things, so I certainly wasn't lacking for any sort of social life because of this. But I was probably one of my favorite things to do would have been read and write. And when I had any time to myself, that's what I was doing. I had some friends who did it alongside me. I had certain friends where they'd come to my house or I'd go to their house and we'd write a story together. I don't know, looking back, how much that was their idea or how much I was kind of forcing them into it. And maybe they got tired of it much more quickly than I did. But I definitely wasn't a social outcast by any means, but this was something that I was passionate about for sure. And I had teachers who inspired me, and I thank them so much. And I had one teacher who had me read aloud my new chapters from this book I was writing every week in class. And I look back at that, and I feel terribly sorry for all of the kids in that class who had to sit there and listen to me read the latest chapter from this book.
One thing that is sometimes a hallmark of the work of youngsters is kind of the assumption that whatever you're writing is wonderful. I certainly think, you know, this is even true. I mean, I'm also a professor of music and a musician, and I think about some of the first things that I composed that I just sort of would blithely assume that because it came out of my own pen, that it must be pretty good. And then at some point there's this moment of reckoning where you kind of realize that's not the case. You start realizing that there are certain things that belong in the wastebasket, and certain
right.
things should be rough drafts, and then you should work to really improve them. And
mm-hmm.
and to me, that's a gigantic turning point in terms of whether or not you're going to become better at what you do. When was that moment for you? Or did you experience that moment pretty early on of wanting to be better?
I experienced it pretty late. I mean, I think when all of these publishers rejected my book in elementary school, I was definitely disappointed, but it never occurred to me then to revise the book. You know, I kind of thought, well, I don't know why they don't see this greatness that I created, kind of thing. I think so. I mean, I don't think that I ever, even to this day, my least favorite part probably of the writing process is revising. I can't stand it. I do it, and I recognize that it makes everything better, and I'm always glad that I did it, but it's my least favorite thing to do. And so then I don't think I revised anything probably until college. I kind of would, and I always, you know, I was getting such positive feedback from my parents and from teachers, and which is a wonderful thing, and it gave me confidence, and it encouraged me to keep going. But it probably would have been beneficial earlier if I had had someone to kind of say, hey, but what if you added more about this, or took this part out, or changed it a little bit? It took me a long time to get to that point. I'd say probably college, when I was studying creative writing, and then realizing and workshopping things and hearing the feedback and giving feedback to other people, that I realized just how much of a process writing is, more so than kind of an exuberant put everything down on paper and it's ready to be published.
Hmm. When you look at your own really early work, how it's hard to phrase this question, how much of your present self do you see there? I mean, I think sometimes that can be a really interesting experience where you see the seed. And sometimes we look at early things and we think, where in the world did that come from? I can't believe
right.
I wrote this or drew this. What is your sense of connection with these early pieces by you?
I see a lot of myself in there still. I've always enjoyed reading the same type of book, which is a realistic, funny fiction, usually school-related, about school stories or something like that. And that's what I've pretty much always enjoyed writing as well. I think one of my strengths as an author is dialogue, and I see good dialogue even in this very early work. There are other things, there are probably more subconscious things that I don't recognize. Some of the more ridiculous elements or the humor, the more childish humor, I look back and I kind of roll my eyes or think, you know, as an adult, I like to think maybe I was above that even when I was a kid, but clearly I wasn't. But I think what was really fascinating to me is sometimes it's easier to see those things in somebody else's work. And knowing the adult work, published work of the authors and illustrators in this book, being able to look at their creations when they were kids, you can see so much in almost all of them, just that seed or that spark of what they were to become.
We're speaking with Alyssa Brent Weissman and talking about the book she edited called Our Story Begins. Your favorite authors and illustrators share fun, inspiring, and occasionally ridiculous things they wrote and drew as kids. Do we have time to talk about a couple of the chapters that are part of this book? There are all kinds of wonderful things here. One of the things that's that really jumped out at me was the work of someone by the name of Marla Frazee, mm-hmm. and a chapter book series she intended to create called June and John. I wonder if you could just say a word about June and John and what you find impressive about this very early work.
Sure. Well, Marla Frazee now is an extremely talented and successful author and illustrator, probably best known at this moment for The Boss Baby, which is a major motion picture. And this is a chapter book, the beginning of a chapter book series she wanted to create when she was 8 years old. And one thing I love about it is that I think she says her father worked for the Heinz Ketchup Company at the time, and so all of the paper that it's on, you can see the Heinz Ketchup logo in the background. And it's about a brother and sister named June and John, and they have a dog named Snoopy. She talks in her introduction about how she would just draw, she would copy the image of Snoopy anywhere she could. And the two of them get into some trouble. They decide to have a lemonade stand, and they get some paint, and the paint falls. And my favorite line of the whole thing is they decide when the paint falls and they can't clean it up with a towel, they need to get turpentine. And the whole thing is written in pencil and then stapled together onto the books, and she drew the illustrations in what looks like magic marker. And somebody wrote some corrections on it as well. She says she doesn't know if it was a teacher or her mother, but there are some corrections on the paper. But I think that the story is really, you know, cute and clever, and it's got these great pictures that I couldn't even draw this well today, although they probably are. They look, you know, they're nothing spectacular. They look like a kid created them. And I think that the story, again, it has these characters. It has a conflict. It's very well done. It's funny. Although I think it's also worth noting that she says in her introduction that this is as far as she got in the chapter book series she was going to create, one book which had three chapters. And then she had to move on to more important things, like trying to set the Guinness World Record for most pogo stick jumps.
Right. But, you know, it's so interesting. It does indeed look like something that a child created. And yet, on the other hand, it's also kind of amazing to see the intense, meticulous, loving care with which she put this together. I mean, clearly this was important to her. And you just can't help but smile at the image of a child working so hard to put something together like
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's just the way that it's the words are then, you know, stapled or glued onto the paper with the drawings, and she's even got the layout differently on different pages. And I think you're right that you can tell the time and the care and the joy that went into creating it.
Absolutely. There's a very poignant story here in the fifth chapter, and this would be an indication of a person where there is absolutely nothing tangible that remains from their own childhood, a childhood spent in the nation of Vietnam. Tell our listeners about this person and what nevertheless is included here.
Sure. So this chapter is from Tang Ha Lai, who says she left Vietnam in a panic. Her family left before the war ended in 1975 when she was 10. And all she has left is one photograph that she provided for the book, that she looks much younger than 10 in the photograph. And the other thing she has left are her memories. And she talks about how her mother was, I love the term she uses, a house poet, who would just recite poetry, but only in the house. It was never meant to be for anything else. And together, she and her mother would create poems and tell each other stories. And then from her memory, she wrote down one of the stories that she remembers coming up with when she was a child in Vietnam. And it's a really wonderful story. It's short, but it's called A Bird in a Cage, about a boy who's trapping some birds in a cage, and then she and the birds conspire to trick the boy. And Tang Ha was one of those people that my editor and I thought would be wonderful to have in the book, but we weren't sure when I reached out to her how that would work. If she had anything, if she did, it would probably be in Vietnamese. And when she told me how she didn't have any tangible objects, but that she still remembered some of the stories that she created orally, and would it be okay if she tried to write one down? And once I saw it and my editor saw it, we both said, this is absolutely perfect. And I'm so glad that we were able to get her and that story, the story itself and the story of her experience in this book.
Right. And, you know, it didn't occur to me until just now as you were talking about this, that it seems to me another important reason for this story to be there is the fact that it really helps one, helps you, helps me, helps all of us appreciate if we have artifacts from our own childhood. I mean, how lucky are you that your parents were able to preserve all of the things that they preserved, and that to this very day, you know, that box can be opened up and you can step back into your childhood. And there are all kinds of people, and not just children who grew up in Vietnam or other war-torn places, torn from their homes, but other people who, for all kinds of different circumstances, cannot turn back to their childhood in this way.
That's right. That's right, for sure.
I wonder if we could take a moment to talk about a really poignant contribution in the very next chapter from someone named Eric Roman. This is a little bit out of the ordinary and such a sweet little story.
Yes. So Eric, who is now a Caldecott-winning illustrator, extremely talented, he provided a Get Well card that he made for his Aunt Helen when he was 9 years old, and he drew her dog, whose name was Butchie, on the card. And so we've got in the book the actual card, and it says, "To Uncle Eddie, Aunt Jenny, and Aunt Helen, I hope you get well soon," by Eric B.R., and then the drawing of Butchie on there. And as he, in his introduction, he says that actually he never even saw or met the dog Butchie. He had just remembered hearing about him. And I think Butchie, he says he had seen Butchie in old photographs, but he'd heard stories that his Aunt Helen told of Butchie fondly, and so he thought when she was sick that it might make her feel better to see something that she loved. And he goes on to talk about how the memories and drawing are a way of helping him see and helping him feel and make sense of emotions. And it's very brief what he writes, but as you say, it is really poignant and really moving. And then, of course, to see it alongside the card itself with the drawing really completes the whole picture.
Absolutely. And I like the way this ends. He writes, "I don't recall Aunt Helen's response to my card, but many years later after her death, I found the drawing in a box among her belongings, carefully folded, wrapped in tissue paper, with my name written on a yellowed bit of tape."
Yes.
And so, obviously, this meant a whole lot to her. And she had taken great pains to preserve it for all these years, and that in and of itself sort of underscores how we don't sometimes even fully understand in the moment just how special something is going to be.
That's right.
I really enjoy Phyllis Reynolds Naylor's early efforts with something called the Food Fairies. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about this?
Sure. Well, Phyllis Reynolds Naylor is an extremely prolific author of more than 145 books, probably best known for her Alice series and also the Newbery-winning Shiloh. And one thing that I love about her that I find so interesting is she grew up during the Great Depression, and so she wasn't allowed to use a piece of paper to write a story or draw a picture because that would have been wasteful. So instead, all of her things that she created, which were many, are on old stationery that had already been used for something else, and most of it here is from the Gospel Trumpet Company. I think her mother worked at the church and brought home this used stationery for her. And so The Food Fairies is a story of all of the items in the refrigerator going to war, and it's very involved and very detailed, and the pictures are very impressive to me. I've never been a talented artist, so I find them to be very impressive. But there's, Mr. Ham and Mr. Egg are in chapter one, and all of these creatures go to war. They have a wedding by chapter four. Oh, there's wieners at war, and there's a great page that has then the wieners lined up for war against the bad drones, and she's got a picture of these hot dogs marching in line, probably also to some degree a reflection of the time at which she was growing up. And I think it's really, really cool that she has this saved from so long ago and that we can see it today.
Absolutely wonderful. Just time for a couple more if you have the time.
Sure, that's fine. I could talk about this book all day.
I understand. I just love it. Chapter 13 is devoted to an illustrator by the name of Chris Gall. And he tells a cute story about what happened to him in the second grade after he was caught doodling on his desk. I want you to talk about Chris Gall and then try to describe to our listeners the wonderful early drawings of him, by him, that are in this book.
Sure. So Chris Gall, who is now known for a number of things, but maybe best known for Dino Trucks, which is also a show on Netflix, I believe. He says when he was in second grade, he was caught doodling on his desk, and his teacher suggested that he might become an artist someday, and then she made him clean all the desks in the classroom, which I think is really wonderful. And he says he tried to draw objects true to life. He says, but my trees looked like nuclear explosions. I tried to draw people's faces, but they always looked like zombies. And he found that it took many years of practice to make a drawing look like what it was supposed to look like. So instead, he would use his imagination. And I love his drawings. They're all in, it seems to be pencil. They're not colored in. And they're the most creative things, almost like architectural renderings. So he's got one of an RV that he would use to travel the world, and it's kind of a side view, and you can see somebody driving this vehicle with a TV. I think it's got four or five TVs in it. That must have been very important. And he's labeled various things, the supply, the antenna. He has another one for his dream home, and it's got a horse and mini bike racetrack. It has a lawn. It even says 50 feet underground. There's atomic power. And it really looks like something that maybe you would have thought he'd go into architecture or design, because these really look like drawings for that. And he says it wasn't until a little bit later that he started then creating stories to go along with his drawings. And it came together that way for him. He has a third one in here that's an underwater lab, and you can see a scuba diver and all of the details of the different rooms within this underwater lab. So extremely creative.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. And it's kind of fun, too, because sometimes at a careless, casual glance, you know, a bunch of children's drawings can kind of all look the same. I mean, and in some respects, mm-hmm. I suppose they do, particularly if it's of the same sort of subject matter. And then every so often, we will come across something, and immediately it's something very much unique, special to that particular young artist.
Definitely, and I think that is for sure true about Chris Gall. It stands out among everything in here.
Another entry in this book that I think stands out in a very wonderful way is by someone named Tom Engelberger. And he has a great sense of humor as he kind of writes about what he has written and what he shares here. And at one point in his little essay, he's talking about how why did I write, in this case, bad encyclopedia entries when I was a kid? I guess for the same reason I wrote bad comics, bad comic books, bad poems, bad jokes, and the start of a bad novel. Basically, I never shut up. I was either talking, writing, or yammering away inside my own brain. Now, describe to our listeners this intriguing sort of encyclopedia that he created.
Yeah, so Tom Engelberger is best known nowadays for his Origami Yoda series, which are very funny, clever books about a boy who creates an origami Yoda that people in his class think can give this, can see the future. And I find it very interesting that this journal that he found and sent me is called Yodium, and it's about this world he created called Yodium, but instead of writing an actual story about it, this seems to just be all the planning. And so it's pretty much, as Tom calls it, an encyclopedia. And it's got 9 sections about all the regions of Yodium. There's Yodium, Lapina, Nastonia. And what he gives, the information he gives, is so dry and so just informational. You know, he says this country depends mainly on agriculture. They grow mostly wheat and other grains, though they also have a shipbuilding business. And then this country is at war with this country. And it's just these detailed notes about this entire world he was building for some epic novel that it doesn't sound like ever got written.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just so interesting to think that this, the creating this, this entirely fictional encyclopedia, you know, of this world that doesn't really exist, satisfied some kind of urge that was inside this young boy. And of course, that's part of what's kind of fun about this, is to just try to imagine, what was this about? I mean, not was the content about, but what was going in, what was going on inside of him, that what was this feeding, or in what way was this fulfilling him?
Right, it's true. And I think, you know, Tom to this day has a great sense of humor. And when I invited him to be part of the book, he was very excited about it, but he wasn't sure he'd be able to find anything. He said he wrote a ton, but he didn't know what he had saved. He was hoping to find, I believe, if I remember correctly, something called Snail Cowboy Comics, which I think also would have been fascinating to see. I think Snail Cowboy could be a book that he might create nowadays. And then I remember distinctly an email he sent me a few months later saying, hit pay dirt when cleaning out my office. An entire, you know, notebook full of encyclopedia, boring world-building stuff. And so he was excited to find this for himself. And I wonder, as you asked me, what it was like to look through and wonder and see my younger self through my work, what he felt looking back at this.
Hmm. We should say that part of the charm of this book is to look at things that have what we fully expect from really, really young writers or really, really young illustrators. In the same way that we are charmed by something that our own children or our nieces and nephews or whoever create, so too we're charmed by these because we are filling in sort of a gap in a story. It's an indication, a precursor of great things that this young person will go on to do as adults.
Right.
And then there are a couple of things here in which they're really wonderful, even as they were created by this young person. I mean, with a level of finish and polish that's really astounding. And I think one of the better examples of that in the book is what was created by someone named Grace Lynn in chapter 23.
I knew you were going to say Grace Lynn, where you were going with that.
So, first of all, tell us.
It's just unbelievably polished. And it's Grace Lynn is well known now for Where the Mountain Meets the Moon and a number of other wonderful books for young readers. And she's an illustrator as well. And she provided a book that she created called Dandelion Story that she entered into a contest when she was in middle school in a national bookmaking contest, and she won 4th place with this book. And we didn't have room to include the whole thing, but we've got the prologue and a lot of the book. And it's just, it looks like watercolors that she used, and it's a story about flowers, and then the wind takes a flower on a journey. And I think she says that she created this, the idea was from a project in school where they had to pick a religion out of a hat, and she picked Taoism, and then create a civilization based around that religion, and she came up with this civilization of flowers. And it really is just, it's just beautiful, and especially the illustrations. And it's one of those things that, to be honest, when I first had this idea, I worried a little bit that everything these people created would be so excellent and so precocious that it would actually be off-putting to young readers, because people might read it and say, like, well, I don't have that much talent right now, so I'm never going to have a future in this. But actually, as you mentioned before, I think there's such a range in here, and some of them are so polished and put together, like Grace Lynn's, and then others are much more representative of what most kids that age are making. And so I think that that's what makes the book really inspirational, because it's not, it's clear that there's, it's not just a matter of, you know, natural talent, that you needed to have this spark right from the beginning, and you have it or you don't. I think most people, you can see the thing that comes through is how much fun they had and how much they enjoyed working, writing, drawing, making up stories. But it was hard work that really made them succeed in the long run.
Absolutely. And to close, I think about something that Chris Grobenstein said in the very next chapter. He includes some things that he wrote as a youngster, and one of the things he talks about is his earnest attempts to use really, really big words,
right.
even words that he didn't necessarily fully understand. He shares an excerpt from an essay he wrote back in the eighth grade, recently discovered in an antique spiral-bound notebook, October 25th, 1968. Autumn is the time of trekking down the cold-nipped street, looking in tranquility at the majestic splendor of the landscape laid out in front of you like a silk linen cloth. And then he goes on to write, yes, I am using big words. No, they are not necessarily the right big words. But there's just something really sort of beautiful about those earnest attempts by a young writer to, in a sense, push themselves past their own point of comfort, in a sense.
Right, right. And he says, you know, in his signature humorous style, that he acknowledges he went overboard. He says, I asked for a thesaurus for my birthday. I asked for a dictionary for Christmas. And then he analyzes those lines of the poem, saying, you know, now he now knows you cannot, that silk and linen are two different cloths. and things like that. But we all have that. I mean, one of those stories that I found in my box was, must have been from something I was reading at the time, that I had this incredibly pretentious air about. I wrote something, you know, it was filled with indeed and words that I would just never speak aloud, that I was kind of, I guess, you know, experimenting with different voices and different ways of writing. And that's one of the wonderful things about looking back at your childhood work, as I said, you know, in that uninhibited way. Chris Grabenstein would never write something like that today, because he knows better and he's probably thinking of what kids and readers and critics will say. But back when he was in middle school and he was writing in this spiral notebook, he was pushing himself to try to see what he could do.
Mm. Well, this book is just endlessly fascinating, wonderful in so many different ways. And I do want to mention to our listeners that two different authors that I have interviewed in the past on this program are represented here, Peter Laranges and Tim Federle, who have both been morning show guests, and they have their own wonderful contributions. This book, again, is called Our Story Begins. Your favorite authors and illustrators share fun, inspiring, and occasionally ridiculous things they wrote and drew as kids. And in almost every case, we are seeing the actual work, the actual drawing, or the actual story as it was written, or even once in a while typed on a typewriter that the young author was granted access to. The book is published by Athenium Books for Young Readers, and the editor, Alyssa Brent Weissman. Alyssa Brent Weissman, thank you for putting together this delightful book, and thank you for joining me today on the morning show to talk about
it. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto. Two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and WGTD in particular. Frank Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD Radio nearly 40 years ago and later served as